Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, as usual. I'm here with Andy Steiger and Chris Battle.
Good to be with you.
Hey, good to be with you as well.
So we're going to continue with part two of Mormonism. But before we get to that, we want to start a segment where we kind of talk about what's going on in the news and the media, just in the culture in general. And we want to talk a little bit about this thing that's been on the news all over the place. And I'm talking about Bruce Jenner, who just recently had a photo shoot for the cover of the Vanity Fair magazine. The title of that cover story was Call Me Caitlyn. Now, Bruce Jenner identifies himself as a woman, and he, as I understand it, he has gone through just about all the procedures physically that you need to go through to physically become a woman. So what's your take on
that? Do we know that for sure? That he's gone through all the procedures?
Well, he's been on hormone pills, and he definitely has silicone in his chest. And
yeah, the physique is looking...
Yeah.
Okay, just pure curiosity.
I'm not sure if he's... Actually, I'm not entirely sure if he's had the sex change operation. Maybe he's had it. I don't know. But anyway, this thing has just kind of lit up.
Erupted.
Yeah, erupted and lit up the internet and the media in general. So just want to hear you guys' take on that.
I guess I'm not surprised anymore at what I see on TV or the news. Interestingly enough, I mean, I don't even have TV. I have a TV, but I'm one of those Netflix people. That's really all I do is watch Netflix. But amazed to me that you can't get away from it, even though I don't watch TV. I read my news whatnot on the internet, and it's just been everywhere. The thing, there's many things that can be said about it.
Well, obviously.
One of the things, though, that I think is quite deeply disturbing is that you can't have an opinion on it unless you're positive. You got to be positive about what he's done, or you're vilified currently.
Right.
This is the effect of the new tolerance, or the concept of new tolerance in society.
Right.
Which is not really tolerant at all, if you think about it.
No, I mean, people have got to get the idea of tolerance. They need to understand the definition of tolerance.
So give us a definition.
Yeah. Let's just give a really simple one. Tolerance is to tolerate something. Intolerance is to not even to tolerate it. You don't even allow it. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, we don't tolerate murder, or we don't tolerate pedophilia, right? If I see it, I will seek to stop it. Mm-hmm. That's intolerance. Mm-hmm. You know, but when it comes to, you know, we tolerate transgender, mm-hmm. right? You can be transgender. The problem I have, though, is that I have to be for transgender. Mm-hmm. I can't have an opinion other than on this topic, and that to me, now that's intolerance.
Because the essence of tolerance is that you disagree with whatever is going on.
Yeah, right? Tolerate it.
Yeah, but you tolerate it anyway. You let it be. But what's being asked of, say, evangelical Christians is that you need to accept this, or you're on the wrong side of history.
Yes. Yes. And that in and of itself is problematic of this whole discussion. The other thing that bothers me with what's going on right now in the media is how people seem to be so totally oblivious to what's going on in culture. Mm-hmm. For example, I recently had a pastor email me. It was actually just this week. He emailed me. He's speaking out at Regent on the topic of apologetics, and he was just asking me, as somebody who's been doing apologetics in Canada, he was just asking, you know, what kind of things have encouraged you and what kind of things have discouraged you that you've seen in Canada. And on the topic of, there's lots of things that encouraged me. On the topic of what's discouraged me is how many Christians, and then non-Christians, people at large, are so clueless of how our ideas have an actual impact in life. Somebody like Bruce Jenner come out and saying that he's now a girl, it is more than just, you know, hey, look at what I'm doing and you need to support me. These ideas have overarching implications to all of life. Mm-hmm. For example, I would put this into the category of a culture of death with regards to homosexuality, transgender, consumerism, narcissism,
Hedonism.
I put those two together, hedonism, and abortion. And what I mean simply there is these are ideas that do not give life. They require life. Mm-hmm. So the very fact that we all can't do as Bruce Jenner has, we all can't choose our gender, we all can't just suddenly decide, I want to become a girl or I want to become a boy. Our culture would literally die if we did that, because it would not be giving life. Just because Chris says he wants to become a girl doesn't mean that he cannot all of a sudden have children and bear life. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. This is a problem. And we see this problem all around us, particularly here in Canada, where our birth rate is so incredibly low.
Which we're talked about by immigration.
That's right. We make up for with immigration, where we import people into our culture that hold a different worldview than we do, mm-hmm. particularly, obviously, a worldview that gives life. And they have an abundance of population where we have not an abundance, and so they come here. Now, this is taking place in France right now, where France in the next couple of years here is going to become a Muslim nation. Now, they're terrified about this.
And by the way, when Andy says the next couple of years, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, so the next couple of years would be about 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. And back when I first started hearing about this and talking about this, it was 20 years from now. Talk.
Yeah.
Now it's a 10 years. And now if you're curious about this, just Google it. Mm-hmm. France is so concerned about this, they're putting policies into place to deal with this.
Yeah.
Even in the United States, that it is projected by the year 2040 that Hispanics will be the majority.
The majority. Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that that's negative. Don't get me wrong.
It's not a bad thing.
No.
But with worldview come consequences.
Yeah, and particularly this consequence of, these things that embrace a culture of death, they don't bring life, and they have overarching implications into all of life. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the areas that really bothers me, that people don't understand that this is actually an important issue, and it affects all of us.
Yeah. And I also find that you can sort of see the underlying existentialist philosophy throughout this whole thing, namely that, because existentialism says existence precedes essence,
right?
So that's where we get the idea.
So you define yourself.
Yeah, by what you do, and things like that. And so it was interesting to me last night as I was going through Facebook, a friend of mine from Bible school years ago, she's very much on this bandwagon, let's celebrate them for who they are. And she said, I am so incredibly thankful that this is happening in my lifetime, where, there's a generation coming where everybody, no matter, their race, their sexual orientation, gender, whatever, they will be celebrated for who they are. And the question that went through my mind is, well, because this was in the context of this whole Vanity Fair magazine thing with Bruce Jenner. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what is he? Is he a man or a woman?
Mm-hmm.
And can he decide? Because I think she bought into the existentialist philosophy that you can do and change yourself. But Christianity says, well, no, essence precedes existence.
Yes.
Right. And so without any sort of essence taking priority, you can turn yourself into whatever you want to.
And this is incredibly important for Christianity, because when we say that essence precedes your existence, mm-hmm. that the imago Dei, or being made in the image of God, then is where we find our ultimate value, self-worth, and purpose. That we were created in God's image, and particularly we've teased this out in zombie culture, that made in a relational image, and that this gives us self-worth that cannot be taken or distorted. Whereas if you're in a culture that you define yourself, right, I'm forgetting how you phrase that with
existence precedes sex.
Yeah, where your existence,
you define yourself by what you do.
Yeah, where you define yourself by what you do. There was a nice way you put that earlier. at any rate, when you live in a culture like that, it becomes very utilitarian. Now, mm-hmm. now your worth becomes very nebulous. You know, mm-hmm. why are you of value? Well, is it what you do? Is it what you believe? Is it having the right cultural beliefs? Mm-hmm. And then this becomes really problematic. So now you become, as Nietzsche would say, you become unchained.
Right.
Right. So now we've got online different people that are, you know, expressing their own desires. So currently one of them is people that want to become handicapped, or it has a name for it. And so some people, they feel that more themselves if they cut off their arm. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is a real thing. Mm-hmm.
I was really wondering about that, because where does it stop? Or, you know, like if
it doesn't stop.
Exactly. If we stop with just gender identity, then that's just an arbitrary stopping point, right?
Yeah.
If you take it to its logical conclusion, then you should be able to turn yourself into whatever you want, because ultimately it's your desire that arbitrates the essence. And so if I
so
want
you got
to
people
be,
trying to marry right. dogs, and you've got yeah, all kinds
trying.
Of stuff.
Yeah, trying.
Or then the kids even say, well, I actually want to be a dog.
I heard that in Colorado somewhere, a man came in with his horse saying that I want to marry my horse. And the city clerk, I think it was, she just really, like, there was no legal basis for her to say no, but she did found a way around it, and that was,
good for
well,
her.
The horse is not yet of age. The horse is not 18 years old yet.
Oh,
that's
wow.
how she got around it, apparently.
Right. See, and the problem for me here is that it changes the question that we should be asking instead of, what was I created for, right? Which is, I think, the proper question. We start always thinking, as a society, who am I? And then we enter into this sort of perpetual state of early high school. I remember going there and the constant identity crisis, where each year it would be, okay, this year I'm coming to school and I'm my fashion is like a cowboy. And then this right. this next year I'm going straight up gangster. And then the right. next year it's preppy. And it's constantly reinventing myself. But where does it end, right? And typically that ends with maturity. But we're creating society where immaturity wins the day, or we're a large group of children running around unchained.
Yeah. Right. And I'm just worried that this will go even farther down. It's already...
Well, how can it not? Right?
Cutting arms off. And I'm thinking to myself, well, with the genetic technology that we have, what stops us from turning ourselves into chimpanzees again?
Right. Or, you know, I know, or messing with that. I know that goes into all kinds of interesting fields. I mean, even for me, you know, with regards to pedophilia, or what's the age that now you can marry somebody. And,
right.
And these are all questions that are all open. They're on the table. Once you crack that open, that box is open. Yeah. There is no foundation any longer. And these are, I think, valid concerns that we all should have, is where will these things lead? Now, back to what you're saying, Chris, I think this is an important idea, that these are ideas of reductionism that are part of our culture, that how are we going to define what a person is? Well, we're going to look into their DNA, and we're going to look into, you know, the parts that make them up. And so some people, though, have decided that the parts that make them up aren't, you know, that it's not quite right. You know, it's not the way they identify, right? And so then they want to mold themselves into this way that they identify. And it's kind of like this mix mash of right ideas and wrong ideas, in the sense that, yeah, you know, you aren't defined by your constituent parts, in the same way we wouldn't define a computer by chipboards and wires and stuff, but we would define a computer by the purpose of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of the thing? Mm-hmm. And I think this is important, though, when we understand what a person is, that we have a purpose to be in relationship with God and to be in relationship with each other. But that has this idea of teleology, that there's a design to things. And that means then that there's not only design to my relationship with God, but there's a design with my relationship to people.
And the surrounding world.
Now, this is just, I guess, to kind of wrap this thing up, and I guess to jump into Mormonism, what's really of concern to me is that we can sit here on this podcast and we can, you know, we can talk about Mormons and what we don't like about them, or what their ideas, and we can bash Mormons, if you will, mm-hmm. right? Nobody's going to put us up on the news or you know, send us hate mail. Mm-hmm. But if you say how what you feel about transgender, mm-hmm. well, watch out. You're going to get it. On that note.
Well, because, and this is the thing, is ideas, as we've said, ideas have consequences. And as we get into Mormonism, right, this is, it's a perfect example of ideas in the mind of a man and a group of people where it can go.
Right. Well, in our secular culture too, like religion is so silly to most people. They just don't even care.
Yeah. It's seen as something of a spiritual fantasy club, right? You just keep it in your own head or just in the private sector. Don't bring it out into the public.
Do you know, C.S. Lewis said something that really shook me up on this in his book, Mere Christianity. He said, why is it that we think it's weird that people in the past burned witches? And then he went on to say, if you thought witches really existed, you'd burn them too.
Yeah.
Right? And
we don't think of that at all. Our understanding of the spiritual life is nil as a society, other than some pseudo...
We're quite secular in our thinking.
Yeah.
And I confess I am. I'm very skeptical. So when I look at Mormonism, I'm very skeptical. But then I have to take that same skepticism to my Christianity. Mm-hmm. Right? And, I mean, even this last week at our church, they talked on David and Goliath. And immediately I get hung up on the height of Goliath, right? Because I'm inherently skeptical.
Was he really 9 feet in?
Yeah. And particularly with the Bible, I find myself overly skeptical of the Bible.
Yeah.
And I can't help but feel that that's a part of our culture.
Or the story of Jonah.
Now, I have good reason for my skepticism of Mormonism, and I'm looking forward to talking more about that.
Yeah, today. So let's get into that. So today, in part two, we want to talk a little bit about Mormon theology. Obviously, we're not going to have time to cover everything, but we Chris found this really interesting article from Fox News back in 2007 in the wake of Mitt Romney running for presidential candidate, and as Mormonism was starting to get a lot of spotlight in the news, Fox News actually had 21 questions that they sent to the Church of Jesus Christ and the Latter-day Saints, a.k.a. the Mormon Church, and they got these 21 answers back, and I will post it on the podcast webpage there. But let's just go through a few of these. What were your impressions as you were kind of reading through the 21 questions?
Well, I think the first one right off the bat is probably the most important one, and that is, why do some call the church a cult?
Right, and that's the very first question.
That's the very first question, and I know from firsthand experience, and just from the dialogues taking place right now, Mormons hate being called a cult. Mm-hmm. And they are working desperately to associate themselves with Christianity, which is very unusual and interesting. Mm-hmm. So they work very hard to do anything they can to ally themselves and to juxtapose themselves with Christianity. That I don't know if juxtapose is a good word for that, but...
identify themselves.
That's the word I was looking for.
There we go.
They're seeking to identify themselves any way they can with Christianity.
Which is interesting because as what we would consider the true faith, it sounds weird saying that. It almost sounds like I'm making some sort of a claim like that. But we want nothing to do. And that's why we use the term cult, because we use it in its proper context, its proper definition, which is it's a fallacious worldview that is, as we discussed, I believe with the Jehovah's Witnesses, is parasitic on something that already exists. Mm-hmm. And
that's right.
So we want to push them away because there's differences that we cannot rectify or we can't justify having and being in fellowship with them. We think they're wrong. Right. Whereas Mormons, they think we're wrong, but yet for some reason they still want to identify.
That's the part that's weird to me. Yeah. They think we're wrong, but yet they want to identify with us mm-hmm. because, and as the question makes it so clear, this is what their answer. They said, For the most part, it seems to stem from a lack of understanding about the church and its core. This is about why they're referred to as a cult, and its core doctrines and beliefs. Under those circumstances, notice what they said. It's a lack of understanding about the church and its core doctrines and beliefs.
So if we would just get it right, we would understand that they are indeed
not
just
a cult.
Denomination, not a cult.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then they say, under those circumstances, it is too easy to label a religion or other organization that is not well known with inflammatory with an inflammatory term like cult. They see this word cult is very pejorative, and they don't want to be associated with it. And I don't think that they'd even want to be called the new religious movement either. I think that they just want to be called Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they do then to identify with Christians and to make themselves seem more Christian is, and this is where this is key in the discussion of Mormons, is they have taken Christian terms and they have adopted those terms, but they use a different definition.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're going to, like, you can have a Mormon at your door and they will sound just like a Christian. They'll sound just like you. Right. And they'll give the answers that sound just like you. But the words that they're using have different meanings than you do. And they're doing this purposefully. Another thing that they're doing purposely on top of that, and we're going to see that come out in this article, is the Mormons have a theology of lying. Now, Muslims have also a theology of lying as well.
Could you explain that?
Yeah, and it's very frustrating if you've ever dealt with it before. Mm-hmm. And that is that it's this idea that because you aren't enlightened, because you don't have a certain level of knowledge, that they need to speak to you in a certain way. They can only talk to you about certain things because you haven't gained enough knowledge to be able to be told deeper truths. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I've had many Mormons at my door or at coffee shops that have denied the fact that they wear holy underwear. They'll just flat out say that's not true. Now, here in this article, I was surprised, but they did admit that they wear holy underwear.
They acknowledge it. As priestly garments.
Yes. So they acknowledge that they had priestly garments. But you'll find, try it for yourself. Ask a Mormon missionary if they wear holy underwear, and you'll get a mixed answer. Sometimes they'll say yes. Most of the time, from my experience, they have said no to me.
Do you think it was because they just didn't know about it, or are you pretty convinced that they were just hiding that?
No, then I know for a fact they have it is allowed for them to not tell you the truth on something, or to hide it, if you will, because, again, they just don't think, they feel like it will be a detriment to you coming to know the truth.
Exactly. It's like the doctrine of don't spook the horses, right? Like,
yeah.
You don't.
That's a great way to put it.
You don't scare them away. You don't scare them away by saying things that could be possibly damaging or confusing or.
Yeah, that's right. Confusing. I don't mean it to that. I'm definitely not saying they're being malicious in it,
mm-hmm.
or deceptive. Although they are being deceptive, they don't mean it in a bad way.
Yeah, they think they have something so good to offer you. It's sort of like
they don't want to get you sidetracked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like wartime exemptions or something like that.
Right. But yeah. Muslims will do it as well. I've had conversations with an imam where I asked him, you know, if when you get to paradise, do you get the 70 virgins? And mm-hmm. and he said to me, absolutely, yes, that's true. And then I asked him, what about girls? And he said they get their own 70 virgins as well. Okay. To which I quipped to him that my wife would think of that more as hell than heaven. And he did laugh. He did laugh. But then I asked another imam, and this one was interesting. He was in the presence of other people when I asked him the same question. And he flat out denied it and said that is nowhere in the Quran or Hadith that...
Really?
Oh, yeah. And
it's almost like he's kind of counting on you not knowing Islam very well.
Well, because I was flabbergasted, right? And the only thing that I could do, and I wasn't trying to pin somebody. I'm very much a student of religion, so I'm always asking people questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm not meaning it to be, like, I'm not trying to, like, pick a fight, or I'm not trying to argue with them.
Spring a trap.
Or spring a trap. No, I want to know. I've read this. Do I understand it correctly? Mm-hmm. Right? And I find it interesting with these different religions to ask different people, different religious leaders, and see what kind of answers you get. I've done this with Buddhism as well. I've asked a Pure Land Buddhist about their doctrine of hungry ghosts and asked them how it compares to Tantra Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, and their form of hungry ghosts, because one, the Pure Land Buddhist takes it metaphorically, the Tantra Buddhist takes it literally. So I wanted to know how he reconciled that. So anyway, I do this with all religions.
Right? I think that's interesting to note, because I know Greg Kokel says that one of the best ways to get to know what different people believe is to actually ask them. Mm-hmm. Is to talk to them. So you meet a Buddhist, get an education in Buddhism, and in our case, you meet a Mormon, get an education in Mormonism.
So When I'm talking like this, I'm saying that's what I'm doing. I'm in that education mode. But what I found in my education mode and these different people is I've found a lot of different answers.
Just discrepancies.
Absolutely, a lot of discrepancies, and really straight up embarrassment. Is where I would go with it.
And also, one thing that strikes me as interesting is it doesn't sound to me like you're just talking to, you know, Johnny Muslim on the street. You're talking to imams, right? Because, I mean, I think
for a Muslim pastor, if you will. I'm talking to the
educated. Because, I mean, if you walk around the streets of Abbotsford and you talk to three different Christians and ask for three different descriptions of the Trinity, or if you ask for a description of the Trinity, potentially you're going to get three different, maybe not three different answers, like in general, but there could potentially be some discrepancies, right? But in this case, it sounds like you're going to someone that should know about something that is...
They should be an authority on it at some level.
There's not like, okay, maybe one might say, well, I think it's 72 or it might be 68, but the concept is there and is knowable.
Yeah. Couldn't you say the same thing about Christianity, though? That, you know, the skeptics could easily come to different pastors and talk to them about any doctrine, and they'll sometimes get different answers from them.
Well, I would say that could take place in the sense of on secondary issues. Mm-hmm. But when you're coming to different churches and you're asking them questions about primary issues that are clear and things that are just clear in their scriptures, mm-hmm. to flat out deny something, I don't see where you would find that. Like, I mean, that'd be like somebody asking about the Trinity, and then one church tells you about the Trinity and the next one denies the Trinity completely.
They have some sort of modalism or something like that.
Right. Or with regards to heaven, you know, mm-hmm. is heaven with, what constitutes heaven? Now, a Christian's going to say that heaven is being in relationship with God, new heavens, new earth. But they're not going to deny it completely.
Yeah. Heaven doesn't exist, for example.
Yeah. Or that's not anywhere in our, scriptures or whatever. Right. And then they're relying on the fact that you don't know them. Entirely. But let me jump into this article and just show you a prime example of one of the ways that they're crafty. So in the Fox News asked them, does the church believe in the divinity of Jesus? To which they replied, Mormons believe Jesus Christ is literally the Son of God. Notice that in every one of these, they do not give a direct answer.
Mm-hmm. It's very opaque.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So Mormons believe Jesus is literally the Son of God. Now you have to ask the question, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Notice they say literally.
Yes.
They put the literally in there.
You could take that in any direction, really. What does that mean, literally?
Well, now I have some material here from...
And here he is with the primary source.
Yes.
Yes.
With an ex-Mormon named Mark Champney. He's a great guy. He has a website, by the way, that's called exmormons.net. So exmormons.net, I'd encourage you, I think, let me just confirm that. Yeah. Exmormon.net. It's a great resource because he has an insider's perspective and can help you to understand, well, what do they mean when they say literally the Son of God? And he would say this, that what they mean is this, that he's a resurrected, exalted man who organized the world with Michael, the archangel, under the supervision of Elohim. Elohim is his physical as well as spiritual father, since the heavenly father had relations with the Virgin Mary to give birth to Jesus. it goes on from there. But you can start to quite quickly see that they mean something quite different than we do. So, anyway, so it says, Mormons believe Jesus Christ is literally the Son of God, the Savior and Redeemer who died for the sins of humankind and rose from the dead on the third day with an immortal body. God the Father also has an notice. God the Father also has an immortal body.
That says a lot, hey.
Well, it's, and I find it really interesting. I also found a great resource. Sorry,
I actually jumped ahead. Oh, so no, that's the sorry. So that's what he said. Right before we get there, what I thought was interesting is then you come to the next question. This was one of the major points I wanted to make. Was the next question was, does the church believe that God is a physical being? To which they reply the exact same thing.
Verbatim. It was copy-paste.
Mormons believe Jesus is literally Son of God. And they're going to do this repeatedly in the article.
In the article, I found that interesting. But as I was doing some of the research on this, I found a really great site. It's called fairmormon.org. And I appreciate it because there's actual Mormons. And they consider themselves Mormon apologists, and they go through some of these.
There are Mormon apologists, by the way.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And, well, there has to be, right? Yeah. Yeah. Wait, I had an inappropriate joke.
I had multiple, and I bit my tongue.
Yeah, I was like, no, Jesus wouldn't appreciate that. So, but at any rate, and it's really an excellent resource because they go through some of these. Topics and try to give an answer for it. But, and I'll just give you the first to point out, though, a lot of these answers are, they're a lot of speculation and a lot of sort of flip-flopping because there's not a lot of areas to go. And in this area of God or Jesus having a mortal body, being conceived of the Virgin Mary, of a physical union, they say, well, whoa, we don't, we don't say that God and Mary actually had sex. That just has been implied, and potentially some of the past prophets have accepted that. But what's possible is that now we have, they're speaking pre-scientific. Now we have some more scientific evidence that potentially, and this is right on the site, you can look at it, potentially there was something along the lines of artificial insemination where, I don't want, like God went in a cup, or something, and do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
But this is a legit option for them that this could be how that union took place and how Jesus was born physically from a literal insemination on God's part.
Now, see, what you need to understand then is the Mormons' understanding of God is quite different than ours.
Yeah.
When, again, here, this ex-Mormon, when he defines what the Father is. And so God the Father is, according to Mormons, a resurrected, exalted man who presides over our world. His proper name is Elohim. He is, but that's the Hebrew name for God. El is the generic name for God in Hebrew. He is only one of many gods, and he himself is subject to his Father before him, whom we know nothing about. He was once a man and progressed one step at a time until he reached godhood. He has a physical body of flesh and bones, as tangible as man's. Like all of us, he also has an eternal intelligence, i.e. soul. Again, that's one of their terminologies. But he was also born to his spirit parents as a spirit being and also was born to physical parents as a physical being. He has many wives and has procreated billions of spirit children, that's all of us. In the same way that children are normally procreated by their parents, we are to follow his example and become gods of our own worlds and populate them in the same way.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how we can misunderstand these core doctrines as being actually similar to our own, yeah. Or even remotely close.
If you remove some of the same kind of words that they use, you would think it's a different religion altogether.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Once you decloak, if you will, the way that they're defining Christian terms.
Right. And one key thing that I've noticed there is that God is a physical being, which yes. means God is inside the universe, right? He has to be sort of under the universe, if you will. Whereas in traditional Abrahamic religions, God is transcendent. He is above, over and above the universe and time and space and everything.
Right. And so this to me, though, is it just reeks of the 1800s of the 19th century, mm-hmm. right? They're given a very, you know, 19th century understanding of their idea of God and their mm-hmm. and as they're compiling different ideas from that time, which is fascinating when you read their material. So this becomes quite problematic then, because you begin this infinite regress of who begot who. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, where does all that end? This is why it's important in Christianity that God is transcendent. He is wholly other and
uncaused cause.
And he's an uncaused cause. God doesn't have a birthday.
Yeah.
This is significant in that you need ground zero, or you get this you get this infinite regress of causes. And God being this uncaused cause, by God not having a birthday, by him being transcendent, non-physical, being outside of the created world, we have a way then to understand how we came into existence. That this world was caused, was created by something that was uncaused and uncreated, that was non-physical in its essence.
And at the end of the day, the only one truly worthy of worship.
That's right. And that becomes significant too, because once you get all of these gods, well, the word God loses all of its meaning. God is that which none greater can be conceived. Yeah.
But we can easily conceive of one, namely the monotheistic conception of God, which is a metaphysically necessary being. But if this God is physical and therefore sort of under the universe, then he can't exist without the universe.
That's right. And if you want to think of something greater than Jesus, well, you think of Elohim. And if you want to think of something greater than Elohim, then you just think about his father. And then you think about his father.
In the Mormon conception.
Mormon conception. Yeah. And this, again, is highly problematic. This is why, and I'm going to say this again, it's one of the reasons why I love being a Christian, is because Christianity has a robust philosophical tradition that it follows rules of reliable thought, and that is a good thing, my brothers and sisters in Christ. Right? And if you want to see how quickly you can see another cult or religion just fall apart, mm-hmm. is just begin to use some rules of reliable thought. Just begin to use some philosophy as you're talking to them, and you can begin to see things quite quickly crumbling. Mm-hmm. Now, this probably surprises a lot of people. I hope it doesn't. That Christianity does have a robust intellectual tradition. And some of the greatest philosophical, scientific minds, both then and now, were Christians.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the times people just think that Christianity is outdated simply by the virtue of the advancement of modern science. But in fact, modern science came from Christianity.
That's incredible.
Let's take another question here. This is one of my favorites. Where is the planet Kolob? Is that how you would pronounce it?
Kolob. That's what I was thinking.
Kolob.
I'm not sure. Kolob. That's how it's spelled.
What significance does the planet have to Mormons?
So where did this come from, this Kolob? And what is the planet supposed to be?
Well, Kolob, it originated out of the And this is the thing, is there's two camps inside either Mormon theologians or apologists, or even extra-Mormon theologian or apologists or whoever, that it's either a star or a planet. Because when you read through the Mormon scriptures, particularly the Book of Abraham, which I was reading through this morning, it's a significant read.
Maybe we could just press pause here for a moment and just explain what are the scriptures.
Oh, sorry, yeah. The main scriptures for the Mormons would be the King James Bible. They use that, though it's their translation of it. They use the Book of Mormon, and they look at those as sort of the two, when you're thinking of, not Isaiah, Ezekiel, like the two witnesses or whatever, they look at the Book of Mormon and the King James Bible as the two ones. But then there's also, you look at things like the Pearl of Great Price and the Doctrine and the Covenants, right? And inside the Pearl of Great Price, inside there is the Book of Abraham. And this is, I believe we touched on it last week, was when Joseph Smith purchased like a sarcophagi, or it was at a an Egyptian yard sale or something like that. This is a little unclear how he's able to get these. There were some documents. There were some papyri. Papyri? Papyri?
Papyri.
Papyri is what I...
Yeah, I was going to say papyruses. Like, I don't know.
Paprika?
But there are some of these. And this is where he came up with his translation for the Book of Abraham. And I mean, since then, the remnants and stuff have been shown to be funerary texts by Egyptologists and essentially shown to be incorrect interpretations. But nevertheless, he talked about the Book of Abraham, that Abraham, the patriarch, wrote this book using Egyptian hieroglyphics. And
which don't... Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, which does not exist.
Yeah, well, what he called their actual, in the papyri, there was actual hieroglyphics that talked about whatever. So his interpretation and designation of them was just merely false.
It was all wrong.
Yeah, and he discussed in the Book of Abraham, this translation, about a planet or star. There's some confusion. Called Kolob, and it's out there, and they helped set time by it, but it was a precursor to Earth, so Earth was formed in its shadow, essentially, and so on and so forth.
Now, with regards to the article, the Mormons wrote back that Kolob is a term found in ancient records translated by Joseph Smith.
Book of Abraham, I'm assuming.
Yep. Yeah. Joseph Smith did not provide a full description or explanation of Kolob, nor did he assign the idea particular significance in relation to the church's core doctrines. Now, that's how slippery the Mormons can be. So as you notice, there's a lot of jostling there. It's like, right, they're trying to say things, but say something, but not too much.
Well, it's because they get that people like Brigham Young and a lot of their early prophets who were supposed to be have the ear of God, right, and have the voice of God, that whatever they said was on par with Scripture. And a lot of these guys would talk about this being the case, that that Kolob would be some place that God reigned. It was like where he was or something along those lines. But yet now they're like...
In a similar fashion, here we are on Earth.
Yeah.
And this is where these spirit children are being born.
Exactly. So now, in a sense, they're backpedaling and using phrases like, well, it was never put into the canon, so it was just a mistake. But they won't use the word mistake.
Here's another one. Does the Mormon Church believe Jesus appeared in North America after his crucifixion and the resurrection? The Fox News asked. To which they replied, the appearance of Jesus in the Western Hemisphere shortly after his resurrection is described in the Book of Mormon. Mormons believe that when Christ told his disciples in the Bible that he had other sheep who should receive his message, he was referring to those people in the Western Hemisphere, of which there is absolutely no record of Christianity in the Americas before the Spanish.
No, not. There's the tools they talk about, or the tools that would have been necessary, the ability to make golden plates, some of the animals,
none of that. Now, interestingly enough, when Christian missionaries went to India, there they found Christianity. It was alive and active.
Yep.
Interestingly enough, so now some people have speculated that perhaps the disciples
Thomas,
you know, had worked his way that way or whatever, and other disciples had worked their way into India. But again, there in North America, no. That's one of the things that I find interesting about the Mormons is that they make a lot of big claims, and this is the part though that's truly amazing to me, astonishing, is that they could make such incredible claims of which there is literally no historical evidence for, and yet thousands of people will believe it.
Well, it has such a firm foundation, right? Like it has such an established footing. It has almost an entire state of the United States, right? And so, and they lean back on the burning in the bosom.
That's right.
So it becomes a matter of faith, because it started before Google, right? If Joseph Smith was kicking around right now and he's like, hey, you know, they're here, whatever, I'd be like, okay.
Yeah, Mormons would have no chance of existing.
There's no way, because you could figure this stuff out. But they were able to establish themselves on this leap of faith sort of
Then too, back then in the 19th century, you know, studies in Egypt were just ripe, right? You know, there were new archaeological discoveries constantly coming out. It was an exciting time in that way. So for him to be discovering these things and whatnot, that would have fit fine in that context right then. Mm-hmm. And it would have been fairly easy to believe in some sense, although still extravagant, right?
Exactly. But
it would have been more difficult at that time to verify what he was saying.
Moving on in the article here, it's kind of interesting. After asking, you know, does the Mormon Church believe that Jesus appeared in North America after his crucifixion and resurrection? The next question is, if so, when did this happen and under what circumstances? And again, here the Mormon Church gives the exact copy and paste answer. You know, the appearance of Jesus in the Western Hemisphere shortly after his resurrection is described in the Book of Mormon, yada, 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 which doesn't really answer the question.
Not at
all. A whole lot. Maybe, you know, if you can figure out when Jesus was crucified, it gives you maybe a small bit of timeline, but doesn't tell you anything about the circumstances, or it's very vague, I would say.
Oh, yeah. It's like they get this doctrine from John 10:16, where it, you know, he says, I have sheep in another fold that I will go to. But in the context, like when Jesus is speaking to a Jewish audience, right, it's the Jews and the Gentiles. Exactly.
Yeah,
so they're the sheep in the other fold. And he's prophesying, if you will, about bringing in the entirety of God's people, uniting the two, not going to the States and to, you know what I mean? And finding the remnant that's left there. Like that's speculation of the highest order, right? Like it's mm-hmm. pure conjecture.
Mm-hmm. One of the ones that I thought was amusing in here was Fox asked, what specifically does Mormon Church say about African Americans and Native Americans? Now, we talked a bit about this last time, to which the Mormons replied, Mormons believe that all mankind are sons and daughters of God and should be loved and respected as such. The blessings of the gospel are available to all. They're like, again, they don't specifically answer the question.
No, they dodge a little bit. And I think that it's partly because there is so much information on what the mistreatment was in the past. And so they're like, we don't really want to touch this one. Yeah. Because it was purely based on race that they, particular people of African descent were pushed out.
Yeah. And this just, to me, tells me that they're ashamed of this particular doctrine. Which, again, if when you have to dodge so many questions and you have so much to be ashamed of, it should at some level begin to get you to wonder about whether or not you should be believing this. One of the things that they asked in here was with regards to women. Does the Mormon Church believe that women must serve men on both earth and heaven? To which they responded, absolutely not. Mormons believe that women and men are completely equal before God in relationship, in relation to the blessings available in the church. Again, this says nothing about women's role to bear spiritual children and how that all looks and the need to be married. The question before this is, does the Mormon Church believe that women can only gain access to heaven with a special pass or code words?
To which they simply said, no.
No.
Yes. Now, interestingly enough, when you study about the temple, this is what you find, that the temple, there's a number of sacred buildings not used for general assembly and worship. You've probably noticed this. These are their more elaborate-looking buildings. These are what's called their temples.
It's quite beautiful, typically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, really well done. Now, so again, you can have these church buildings that they have, what they'd call them wards, I believe. So you have a ward, but the temple is different. And these are, they're not used for general assembly and worship, but instead they're used for secret rituals they're performed inside, including endowment ceremony in which the participant receives secret signs, tokens, and handshakes believed to be important when the person passes certain checkpoints on his or her way to the celestial kingdom after he dies. Much of the time, these rituals are performed in proxy ceremonies for dead persons whose names have been obtained from genealogical research. Only about 1 in 6 Mormons meets the requirements for a recommend, and are allowed within. So clearly, not a lot of Mormons get in to the temple.
Wow.
So what's with this Mormonism being polytheistic? You hear that sometimes, right?
Yeah, it's the interesting thing is the LDS doesn't believe that they are polytheistic. In fact, they've taken the term polytheist and they've redefined it into meaning that a polytheist is someone that worships a pantheon of gods. And they use the Greeks or the Romans as an example. And they say that as monotheists, or they are monotheists because they only worship one god. But they fully admit that there's more than one. For instance, quote here on Fair Mormon, so this is a Mormon saying this, "The facts that the LDS do not believe that the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost are in one substance," and just to give some context, that's what we would believe as evangelical Christians, that the Godhead is one substance, but it's three persons, so three in one. So that they don't believe it's in one substance, that they each have their own, and they believe in deification or theosis, and in brackets they say that humans may eventually become deified, so may eventually become gods.
Become gods, yeah.
Yeah, humans can become gods and become partakers in the divine nature. They say this has been used to paint Mormons as polytheists, but they don't see that as evidence at all because of their redefinition. But in fact, polytheism merely means the belief that numerous gods exist, more than one god exists, mm-hmm. and monotheism, that only one god exists. It has nothing to do with how many you worship, because even if you take for consideration the Greeks or Romans, they would... like they would set up a temple to Artemis, right? And some would
just worship one.
Exactly, but yeah. You would never call them monotheists.
No, they were definitely polytheists.
Exactly. And so this is the case, I think, with the Mormons. So they've just fallen under this assumption that because they've redefined a word, that now we just can't call them that, because under their definition of polytheists, they don't fit it. But this is the thing, when you come up against reality, reality doesn't care what you think, right? Reality cares about what is true.
Well, it gets back to what we've talked about before, that they have this policy of redefining terms and mm-hmm. and making them fit really into a mold that will make them look more Christian.
Yeah.
The reality is they believe in this, what I've often heard is this organization of like an organization, like a company,
yeah,
of gods. And that is the Godhead, if you will. And this is kind of their understanding of how God is one, in that he is like one organization of which there are many gods.
Yeah.
Right. Even there, again, the idea of Godhead is completely different, right? Because as you described it there, it's gods of multiple substances, right?
But inside one substance.
Yeah. Of which you can become one. You can become a god as well. Now, Christianity, why don't we give a definition for the Trinity?
Trinity is basically the idea that God is one in essence, but three in persons.
Now, another way you can understand essence that I've found helpful, as Darren Latham once told me, the penny dropped for him with regards to the Trinity, was that God is one soul, mm-hmm. one essence, one soul, three persons. And this is not only important theologically, this is important philosophically. So I believe that the Trinity is an incredibly important doctrine. I know some Christians are like, should we be concerned about the Trinity because it sounds weird too?
They want to bail out on that, like the Mormons want to bail out on a lot of their doctrines,
right?
Because it's confusing potentially.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like, or they don't want to bring it up,
mm-hmm.
but it's like, no. We want to bring it up, and it's incredibly important, this idea of the Trinity. Now, we talked about this quite a bit in our zombie culture podcast. But it's important to understand that without the Trinity, there are many qualities of God that you just don't have any longer, such as God being a God of love and God's goodness. How do we know what right relationship is unless God lives in right relationship within himself? Mm-hmm. Now, again, we would say this is one God in three persons. Now, that is difficult for us to understand because we are one essence, one soul with one person.
Yeah.
However, we do get the sense when we're in family that there are three forms of love. Again, we talked about this last time, that I can have a love for myself, I can have a love for another person, mm-hmm. and then we can have a child, and together we can have love together for our child. Again, though, this idea of relational love would be foreign to God unless God was relationship in his very essence. So what I think happens, though, is we've just got to be careful, and I'll stop with this, again, is that we don't impute human characteristics onto God. We would call that anthropomorphic language, but that it's theomorphic in that it's God, that it's God's image in whom we've been made, not that God's been made in our image.
He's the standard.
Yeah, he's the standard. And this doctrine actually helps us to, this is important, that philosophically, this doctrine not only is theologically correct, but philosophically helps us to understand a lot of things that we otherwise wouldn't have access to. And it is important.
It has explanatory power.
Exactly, it has explanatory power. So there's some of them. There's okay. lots more that we could talk about here.
Yeah, there's a lot more here, but I think we're just going over the 45-minute mark, so I think we'll wrap it up here, and we'll let you read through the rest of it. Do we want to go into part three of Mormonism?
You know, we'll find out. I'm not sure if there's any listeners that have more questions about Mormonism, perhaps you could send those to us.
Yeah, and you can email us at info@apologeticscanada.com. Or if you'd like, you can contact me directly, steve@apologeticscanada.com, and we can certainly address maybe not all of them, but at least some of them.
Yeah, we'll look into those. I think next week we'll start in on Islam.
Islam.
And the interesting connections that they have with Mormonism.
Mm.
There we go.
There's your teaser.
I can't wait to listen next week.
I can't wait to do the recording next week.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for listening in. We'll come back next week on Islam. Yes, Islam. Thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada. We'll see you next week.